The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Demi Arsenault for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the summer 2026 issue of Discover magazine. We'll begin from our hot science department. Really interesting article entitled, An Acquired Taste. Marine fungi can eat plastic pollution. Could they be conditioned to help clean our oceans? From delicious fish to delectable corals and cephalopods, the creatures off the coasts of Hawaii have plenty of choices for food. While hungry herbivores consume algae, large predators like tiger sharks devour sea turtles and seals, as smaller predators like mantis shrimp dine on crabs, clams, and snails. But there's one type of organism in these waters with a much more peculiar taste for a decidedly trashy treat. According to a December 2024 study in Mycologia, marine fungi, many of which consume the decaying material of deceased plants and animals, also have an appetite for polyurethane plastic, one of the most prevalent and detrimental pollutants in our oceans today. Decomposing the plastic and turning it into food, these fungi could be used to clean up our oceans, and to top it all off, they could even be conditioned to do it faster, making them a powerful tool in the fight against plastic pollution. Plastic today in the environment is extremely long-lived and is nearly impossible to degrade using existing technologies, said Rania Steinbeck, a study author and a former undergraduate student at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, in a statement. Our research highlights marine fungi as a promising and largely untapped group to investigate for new ways to recycle and remove plastic from nature. Marine fungi account for around 5% of the total biomass in our oceans today. But despite their prevalence, only a small portion of marine fungi species have been described by scientists or studied for their plastic-consuming potential. Few people study fungi in the ocean, Steinbach said, adding that less than 1% of marine fungi are documented at all. After the initial encounter, the team also, quote, experimentally evolved, unquote, the fastest-growing fungi to see if they could consume polyurethane more rapidly the more they were exposed to the plastic. We were shocked to find that more than 60% of the fungi we collected from the ocean had some ability to eat plastic, Steinbeck said. We were also impressed to see how quickly fungi were able to adapt. It was very exciting to see that in just 3 short months, a relatively short amount of time, some of the fungi were able to increase their feeding rates by as much as 15%. The study authors are currently working to see if these marine fungi can break down other forms of plastics, such as polyethylene and polyethylene terephthalate. They're also trying to understand how these fungi degrade these plastics at a cellular and molecular level. We hope to collaborate with engineers, chemists, oceanographers, and more who can leverage these findings into actual solutions to clean up our beaches and oceans, Steinbeck said. And that was written by Monica Call. Our next article is a spotlight article titled Science-Minded Travel, America's Wonderland. Yellowstone is the only park in America where you can watch bison roam, hear geysers erupt, and walk along ancient rocks all in one weekend. It's also the perfect place to see science up close. Many people consider a trip to Yellowstone the quintessential park experience in the western United States. Over 4 million visitors flock to the 2.2 million acre park every year to witness grazing bison and exploding geysers, stepping into a natural laboratory that's been shaped by eons of constant change. It's only fitting, then, that Yellowstone was once known as Wonderland, back before it became the nation's first national park in 1872. And even after all these years, the park's natural wonders have stood the test of time. Primarily located in Wyoming, with parts stretching into Montana and Idaho, the terrain of Yellowstone National Park took millions of years to emerge. During its earliest days, continuous mountains dominated the landscape, but the majority of them were gradually whittled down by wind, water, and ice. Then, around 2.1 million years ago, Yellowstone was plunged into a transformative era marked by three cycles of volcanism. It kicked off with Huckleberry Ridge Tuff eruption, followed by the Mesa Falls Tuff and the Lava Creek Tuff eruptions around 0.8 million years ago and 1.47 million years later. The three explosions were sparked by a stationary hotspot that lies beneath Yellowstone's surface. This hotspot is where plumes of molten rock rise from deep within the earth, creating chains of volcanoes and fueling the tectonic and volcanic activity that's been seen at the park today. Lava flows continued well after the three ancient eruptions, filling calderas, which are large crater-like cavities, that had formed around after each explosion, with the most recent lava flow occurring around 70,000 years ago. The volcanic commotion has since piped down, but that's not to say the park's more recent geologic history has been any less eventful. Lakes have come and gone. Glaciers have swept through the land, leaving sediment deposits and carved valleys in their wake. To Michael Poland, the scientist in charge at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, the ongoing transformation of Yellowstone from prehistory to present day is what makes the park so special. Even on top of the volcanism, you have this really interesting geologic veneer that's a story of how the area has changed over time, Poland says. Yellowstone's volcanic activity is far from finished. The park sits atop an active supervolcano, after all, and it may eventually explode with another major eruption, flooding the area with flows of rock and gas and spreading plumes of falling ash to the surrounding states. Will Yellowstone unleash such a cataclysmic explosion anytime soon? Not likely. The annual probability of volcanic eruption is on the order of 0.001%, wrote Mark Stelton, the deputy scientist in charge at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, as in one of the organization's Caldera Chronicles columns from 2024. But even this low number is probably an overestimate for the short term. The improbability of an eruption this century hasn't stopped scientists from keeping close tabs on what's happening underneath Yellowstone, however. To do this, they typically use seismic tomography, a technique which turns the seismic waves from earthquakes and other underground rumblings into 3D models of the Earth's subsurface. In January 2025, a study in Nature took a different approach. Examining the many magnetic fields created by the pockets of magma beneath Yellowstone, researchers found that reservoirs of molten rock are moving toward the northeast portion of the park, where they are being heated by a deeper, hotter magma from below. This could be a harbinger of future eruptions, although researchers note that the reservoirs aren't melted enough to be eruptible at this time. Their melt fraction, which is below 20%, is less than half of what's required for an eruption. Scientists' diligent monitoring of the park's volcanic and seismic activity doesn't just look to the far future, however. It also keeps visitors safe and well-informed today. Modern hazards at Yellowstone include earthquakes, which occur 700 to 3,000 times a year, although most are not felt, and hydrothermal explosions, which occur annually. These bursts of rock and mud form as water transitions, or, quote, flashes, into steam, changing the pressure within the Earth's crust. Many of these explosions cause craters, and on occasion they bring some surprise additions to the park. In April 2025, for instance, park geologists were surveying Norris Geyser Basin when they came across a pool of silica-rich water that had taken on a milky blue hue. They determined that the pool had likely started to develop in December 2024 following a series of small hydrothermal explosions. The unpredictability of these blasts is part of what makes every visit to Yellowstone different, Poland says. There's always some new form of activity or some new feature or some change of the features. It's endlessly interesting in that way. It never is the same place twice. Thermal pools and steaming vents pop up at Yellowstone all the time, adding to the park's eclectic mix of 10,000 hydrothermal features, and seeing them firsthand provides a sensory experience like no other. At the northern end of the park, for example, you'll find the step-like terraces of the Mammoth Hot Springs, shaped by streams of hot water that have deposited tiers of calcium carbonate over time. Travel south along the Firehole River to the Upper Geyser Basin, and you'll eventually hear the thundering eruptions of Old Faithful as it spouts boiling, silica-rich water. And if you head out east to the Mud Volcano area, be prepared for a whiff of rotten egg stench, courtesy of the pungent hydrogen sulfide consumed by the mud-dwelling microbes. Each geyser basin almost has a bit of personality to it in terms of the landforms and the style of activity that you may observe, and that's due to the chemistry of the material and the temperature of the material at that location, Poland says. Each one tells a story. Every new feature of the park that is discovered fuels future research, solidifying Yellowstone's role as a natural laboratory. Sometimes it seems like for every question we answer, two more are raised, Poland says. But I think that's a sign of us being able to learn that we are asking the right questions. We may be able to solve one problem, but it leads to two more. And that takes us down new paths to better understand how some of these features work. Yellowstone's role as a natural laboratory extends to its rich ecosystem, inspiring studies that paint a clear picture of the park's vibrant animal and plant communities. Researchers pay close attention to the relationships within these communities, taking note of the broader ecological effects they generate. In the 1920s, for instance, wolves were eliminated from the park, due to deliberate eradication efforts, triggering a cascade of effects on prey and plant species alike. But when wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone in the 1990s, researchers began to document decreases in the population of over-browsing elk and increases in the populations of willows and aspens, complicated changes that some scientists believe brought a bit of balance to the park's ecosystem, though their exact cause and extent are still being studied. To engage with the wildlife at Yellowstone, visitors can join citizen science teams that track bison or red-tailed hawks, or even help carabid crews that gather data on the park's carabids or ground beetles. They also can enroll in the many educational programs offered by Yellowstone Forever, the official nonprofit partner of the park. Amanda Haggerty, the chief program officer of Yellowstone Forever, says that field seminars are a perfect way for visitors to become more familiar with their favorite species, for example. If you want a deep dive on wolves, Haggerty says, a field seminar can give you an extensive look at all things wolf. While scientists guide participants through the park, community members with varying backgrounds are brought in to speak, from wolf watchers to local ranchers, covering the animals from a scientific and a cultural perspective. The goal is not to overwhelm people with facts, but it's really to help ideas click so that science and what they're learning in the park feel accessible and engaging, she says. Haggerty also points to the impact of talking with field educators and rangers who are there to help visitors understand the park on a deeper level. From an education perspective, it's really phenomenal because you don't have to imagine how science works. You're standing right in it, she says. With so much to do at Yellowstone, it's hard to imagine exploring every single feature in a lifetime. Poland says he's heard from some people who want to climb all the park's peaks or hike all its trails. Very few, he says, have accomplished such gargantuan tasks. Even more impressive than the park's scope is its unpredictability. It's impossible to anticipate what exactly you'll experience when you visit Yellowstone, Haggerty says, recalling a moment at the Madison campground when she was sitting around a fire with her family. All of a sudden, the whole campsite was bathed in an intense glow. Looking up, she saw a massive fireball streak across the sky, then split in two. About a half minute later, she heard a crash and a boom like thunder. It turned out that fireball was a meteorite. The scene, made especially striking by the lack of light pollution at the park, was, quote, a little bit terrifying, but absolutely unforgettable, she says. For Haggerty, that moment puts everything about the park into perspective. That ties into what I've learned about Yellowstone. It really rewards curiosity. The more I want to learn about the place, the more I want to learn about this place, the more I feel rewarded with learning about it, because it's constantly changing. Of course, all these transformations are science at work. As much as Yellowstone is a natural wonderland, there's a science story there about how curiosity and trying to understand more about the natural world has these benefits that we may not realize immediately. But that can be pretty important to society, Poland says. And that was written by Jack Knudsen. Our next article is from our Origin Story column, entitled, A Species Cuts Short. Homo floresiensis, a small hobbit-sized human, thrived on the island of Flores. Then the species vanished. For more than 140,000 years, Liang Bua, a limestone cave on the Indonesian island of Flores, hummed with human activity. Then sometime around 50,000 years ago, the cave fell silent. Homo floresiensis, the 3-foot-tall hobbit human that long occupied the site, had disappeared. Scientists found their first H. floresiensis specimen at Liang Bua, almost a complete skeleton that they called LBI, around 20 years ago. Since then, the teams have found fragments from a handful of other skeletons, all at the same site, and have learned a lot about the species, from its physical features to its favorite foods and tools. But the hobbit's disappearance has long stumped scientists, leaving behind one of the biggest mysteries in human evolution. Recent research has started to solve this mystery, suggesting that climate change may have contributed to the hobbit's sudden disappearance. Reported in Communications Earth and Environment in December 2025, the research shows that a period of reduced rainfall shrank the river's regions and slashed its prey populations, transformations that may have forced the hobbits from their cave, contributing to their eventual extinction. The ecosystem around Liang Bua became dramatically drier around the time Homo floresiensis vanished, said Mike Gagan, a paleoclimatologist and an honorary professor at the University of Wollongong in Australia, in a statement. Summer rainfall fell, and the riverbeds became seasonally dry, placing stress on both the hobbits and their prey. Flores is a small island, a mere 220 miles across, famous for its lush landscape and its limestone caves, including Liang Bua. Tucked away inside a small river valley, this multi-level, multi-chamber cavern provided a large, sheltered living space, perfect for the hobbit humans to call home. Today, the cave is inundated with rain, particularly in the summer monsoon season. The surrounding region is too, however, that wasn't always the case. For years, studies have pointed to climate changes on or around Flores, though whether these trends played any part in the hobbit's disappearance has remained uncertain. In fact, previous paleoclimate results have hinted at possible periods of reduced rainfall, yet these periods have lacked a clear site-specific chronology, and thus any clear connection to H. floresiensis's fate. Setting out to trace the patterns of rainfall in the lead-up to the hobbit's disappearance, Gagan and a team of researchers turned to two sources of evidence, cave stalagmites and fossilized teeth from the creatures the hobbits had hunted. Stalagmites develop in thin layers as water drips from cave ceilings to cave floors, locking in the chemical signatures of the past rainfall. By analyzing these layers from Liang Bua, the researchers reconstructed thousands of years of local climate change, revealing a long-term drying trend that began around 76,000 years ago. The record shows that by 61,000 to 55,000 years ago, the trend had transformed into a severe, prolonged drought. To understand how this shift affected the broader ecosystem, the team paired the stalagmite record with the isotopic analysis of the teeth of pygmy elephant Stegodon florensis insularis. These elephants, which were hunted by hobbits, depended heavily on river water, and their enamel recorded increasingly arid conditions as rainfall declined. Their population collapsed around the same time that H. floresiensis disappeared, signaling that one of the hobbits' key food sources was also in crisis. Together, these two archives reveal that the landscape outside Liangbua was drying rapidly, and as the drought intensified, the ecosystems around the cave began to unravel. Rivers dwindled, vegetation thinned, and the pygmy elephant population diminished, leaving hobbits with fewer resources to survive. Surface freshwater, Stegodon, and Homo floresiensis all decline at the same time, showing the compounding effects of ecological stress, said Jarrett Vanderberg, another paleoclimatologist and an honorary fellow at the University of Wollongong. Competition for dwindling water and food probably forced the hobbits to abandon Liangbua. As they left the cave, the hobbits may have entered areas where modern humans were present. Homo sapiens were crossing the Indonesian archipelago at around that time, raising the possibility that climate-driven displacement brought the two species into contact, perhaps exposing the hobbits to increased conflict or competition. The researchers say that their findings highlight how shifting rainfall and environmental stress can alter the course of human history. It's possible, as the hobbits moved in search of water and prey, they encountered modern humans, Gagan said. In that sense, climate change may have set the stage for their final disappearance. And this was written by Anastasia Scott. And finally, from our vital signs division, confusion reigns. After collapsing at work, a businessman was rushed to the hospital, spouting gibberish. All signs pointed to a stroke, except one. A stocky, business-suited 60-year-old rolled in from the ambulance, spewing a stream of almost words. He'd mutter. He'd look at you, pause, then continue to mumble unintelligibly. The medics had opened his shirt to place monitor stickers that would track his heart activity, but aside from that and his mysterious language barrier, he looked ready to go to a board meeting. Name is Bill Sutherland, doc, the lead paramedic said. Co-workers said he seemed okay in the morning, but at noon found him slumped at his desk. They tried to wake him, but he made no sense. Vomited once. The only history was type 2 diabetes. We thought slam-dunk diagnosis, hypoglycemia, but the glucose was 170. He didn't have low blood sugar. Life's never simple, is it? I said. How are you, Mr. Sutherland? I asked the man. Brow furrowed, he struggled to say something intelligible and then slumped back. Gail, his assigned nurse, and I eased him out of his jacket, tie, and shirt. She attached the overhead monitor. Blood pressure was 180 over 20. Heart rate was 110 beats per minute, both moderately elevated. But oxygen level and temperature were bang on normal. He sure sounds weird, Gail mused. She rechecked his blood sugar, 190. No clues there. Heart, lungs, and abdomen checked out normal. We watched him try to form words, then give up. With a little prompting, he could move his arms and legs, but couldn't consistently follow commands such as touch your right ear with your left thumb. Could be a posture infarct, I told Gail. Let's call a code stroke. You think, she replied, a stroke without arm or leg weakness or facial droop? The base of the brain resembles a celery stalk with a plum attached. The stalk, the brainstem, connects body to brain and houses the clusters of neurons, or nuclei, that integrate facial expressions, eye movements, swallowing, and alertness. The plum is the cerebellum, the little brain, which coordinates the body's muscle movements. It's all packed in so tightly that a tiny clot in a feeding artery can trigger a dizzying array of symptoms, yet miss the motor pathways for the arms and legs. The brainstem and cerebellum are fed by the vertebral arteries at the back of the neck. Only 20% of all strokes arise from blockages to these vessels. But these cases, called posterior circulation infarctions, can be so confusing that they are misdiagnosed at twice the rate of anterior circulation strokes, which arise in the carotid arteries or their branches at the front of the neck. Good points, I told Gail. But his blood pressure is high, which fits with stroke. Also, when a clot hits the nuclei for throat muscles, patients can't phonate and they sound drunk like he does. Hit the cerebellum next door and the speech coordination gets double whammied. We'll see what neurology thinks. A stroke code is the in-hospital 911 that rapidly motorizes lab, pharmacology, neurology, and radiology resources to accurately diagnose and quickly treat strokes if they meet good criteria with the clot-busting drug TPA. The ideal door-to-door drug time is 45 minutes or less. We sped Mr. Sutherland to the scanner suite for a CT scan. Meanwhile, Dr. M, the neurologist on call, joined me in radiology. He was a solid, but sometimes too by the book doctor. The scan showed no hemorrhage, which would have ruled out our administering TPA. So we have blood pressure 180 over 120, history of diabetes, sudden onset of garbled speech and confusion. Am I right? Dr. M recapped. After I confirmed this, he examined Mr. Sutherland and decided, let's start TPA. 24 minutes since Mr. Sutherland came in, something nagged. If this was truly a stroke, the sooner we gave TPA, the more brain cells we would save. But I wasn't sure. And we still had 20 minutes before the optimal time window for TPA closed. How about we CT angio him, I suggested. Make sure there's really an occlusion. His exam shows no specific weakness, don't you think? A plain CT scan can easily detect a brain bleed because the pooled blood stands out sharply from brain tissue. But it cannot tell whether an artery is blocked. A CT angiogram, or CTA, uses intravenous contrast to highlight the brain's entire arterial system and can pinpoint the artery, which artery is blocked, to confirm the need for TPA. But it takes longer. There's a small risk of kidney damage from the contrast dye that's injected to the brain's blood vessels. When a stroke is clinically obvious, a plain CT that rules out bleed is evidence enough to go ahead with TPA. But Mr. Sutherland's stroke wasn't obvious, at least to me. And TPA can cause catastrophic bleeding in small but real percentage of patients. The clock was ticking. Dr. M winced. He needs TPA now. I'll speed him right through the CTA, I urged. 10 minutes. Dr. M grudgingly agreed. Gail had her doubts, too. He keeps repeating the same word salad, she said. Never seen a stroke like it. CTA should answer the question, I reassured her. And I'm going to skip ahead so you don't have to wonder what happened to Mr. Sutherland. Mr. Sutherland's confusion wasn't exotic. Severe infections anywhere in the body, diabetic or not, can trigger brain malfunction. Whether this occurs due to the body's own counterattacks, bacterial toxins, or both is tough to pin down. And, of course, that article has been abbreviated for the sake of time, but I would encourage you to go and read it on Discover Magazine. And unfortunately, we've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. I hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Demi Arsenault, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful day.